Hi, everyone. Thanks. Trust. So we're definitely not HoloLens specific. We are going to be talking much higher level than that, megatrends and where it affects computation and design. It's one of my favorite talks. It's been evolving quite a bit. So this new iteration we'll be presenting here today. So quick little bit about me. I joined Microsoft 4 years ago. I've been, I guess they sometimes say I'm a submarine participant at the garage, where I pop up every once in a while and then nobody sees me for like 6 months, and then I pop up later from the wilderness. So the boxing robots, Howard and Sheldon, that we did when we first got here with Clint Rutgers, Brian Peek, and Dan Fernandez for Coding for Fun, those are around the cube. So since I've been at Microsoft, I've really been focusing on this cultural intersection between design and emerging technology with a strong passion toward teaching and evangelism. Talking about how creatives leverage code has earned me a bit of a reputation in my 4 years since I've been here at Microsoft. Anywhere but Microsoft, this would be viewed as a bad thing. It's okay that I'm kind of the crazy guy talking about artists need to know how to code, right? And engineers need to embrace design. But this is what I've been doing quite aggressively here. So you've probably heard some of my talks in the past. This was a talk I gave for quite some time, the difference between production engineering, how they approach code as Legos, very object-oriented, reusable, repeatable, and yet creatives, when we started picking up code around a dozen years ago, we would approach it more like clay, freeform and expressive. And this starts developing different cultures of engineering, what Golan Levin from Carnegie Mellon calls production engineering versus experimentalist engineering. This is one of the talks I gave for quite some time. I would talk quite a bit about trickle-down innovation that you tend to see at the top, as well as what's happening in open source in the creative movement, and you kind of have this trickle-up inspiration that's coming from libraries such as processing and open frameworks. This is also one of the themes I would talk about. But around last year, I stopped talking for a while. And it's not that I didn't believe in this message, it's just that my spidey sense started tingling in a way that only happens around once every decade or so, right? It happened in the early 90s with the web. It happened 10 years ago with responsive design, what we call now responsive design. But this idea that our intuitions around what page layout looks like for the web should just map book layout. And we started moving toward mobile. Something was really bugging me, and I wasn't sure what that was, and so I stopped giving public talks for a while. I was called to do a keynote at SODA, the Society of Digital Agencies, last year, and I kind of took some time out to really figure out what's going on, because now Satya's here, all this stuff was coming out, and last year was a big year. And it's bigger than just this trend when we think about virtual, augmented, and mixed reality. And just as a quick clarifier, for the purpose of this talk, when I'm talking about virtual reality, we are talking about this idea of putting your mind into the machine, or your perceptions into a machine. This was what was originally called the rapture of the nerds, right? It kind of started off in the early 80s to the early 90s, and there was a lot of us at that time. We were really, really good at math and science, maybe not that good with the social skills. Maybe we stayed home or played Dungeons and Dragons on Friday night, and we loved this idea of creating this universe where we can go in as God mode, and that would be this rapture of the nerds. Society spoke toward the end of the 90s and said, we actually like reality as it is. What we'd love is if computation could come out and start augmenting our experiences in reality, because unlike you guys, we like reality. And now we're at this point, which we'll get heavily into, where there's this third pattern that's coming up, and these are all words that are being used and redefined in a very fluid way, but now we have things that are mixed reality. And I personally define mixed reality as when these augmentations or virtual projections are not simply enhancing your experience, they are attempting to be first-party citizens of your reality. So not all augmented reality experiences are necessarily mixed reality. If the thing is trying to be a hologram or something that is supposed to be a first-party citizen of your reality, that to me is more of a mixed reality technology. It is not just a perception-based technology as well. There's also projection-based mixed realities that have nothing to do with wearables. We'll also be talking about that in a while. But we know that this hit what the Gartner Group has called the peak inflation of expectations. Everybody you see, The Verge, Polygon, wherever you go, everybody's talking about 2016 as the year of VR. right? Oculus is coming online, Vive is coming online. 2016 is the year of VR. There's all these expectations of what's happening. And yet we know, I believe, and many people believe, while this is at this peak explosion, it's everywhere in CES, you've already seen cottage industries coming in and getting obsolete already. We're at this peak hype before devices are even out. I do believe we'll enter a trough of disillusionment. I think that should be expected as the ecosystem starts catching up, as paradigm catches up, as content enablers and content creators catch up and shift their thinking. But I do believe significantly that this is different from the other hypes that have happened throughout the years around augmented reality, thought control, virtual reality. Something different has happened that has actually caused a shift from the ground up to swing and it not just be a new marketing play. Because we've seen this trough and peaks with VR for the past several years, but something is different now. And that's what we're going to talk about. Last year we released Windows 10. We redefined what Windows 10 is, what it is to be Windows device, and we now are from skin scale to hand scale, arm, torso, body, room scale, wearable with HoloLens. This is all Windows 10. And unlike before, this was the big flag we put in the sand, a dream that many people have been trying for decades to do. We have finally also created an API to be the thing that drives all of these experiences. And yet the way I experience technology here is very different than how I experience technology down there and very different from how I experience it up here. So the design challenges have actually gotten harder while we've been trying to make the coding challenges easier, because we now have this API. We have this one ring to rule them all, right? This one ring to call them, this one ring to bring them all, and on our platform bind them. And we kind of have this approach now that we're trying to get out into the world, but we still have a disconnect between designers and developers here. But to really understand how this plays into what we're talking about, to really understand what's happening with Windows 10 as a big level, and I think the smarter you are here, the more heads down you've probably been on working on one part of this problem. So I want to take a minute and zoom out to really understand what it is that's happening. To understand Windows 10, you have to understand, put it in its context of more personal computing. We have said Windows 10 is our first step toward more personal computing, and this is the big thing that's happened from when I joined the company to where we are now. But to really understand more personal computing, you have to zoom out even farther and understand, really grok what we mean when we're saying mobile first, cloud first. Because this is the thing that is redefining every single organization and group inside of Microsoft. I'm sure in your own team you've heard this. I'm sure in your own team you've heard it in very different ways. It could be as aggressive as we either adapt and conform to this future or our team risks being obsolete. This is the crucible that has been redefining Microsoft since Satya. A lot of people view this as just marketing, right? Leave it to Microsoft to create a list of items that have two first places, but no. It is actually a lot deeper than that. So this is what will be driving VR and AR and zero UI, and we'll get to that. But let me explain quickly what this is from a zoom out level. Mobile first, cloud first is the perfect storm of three transformations that have redefined computation. This first perfect storm was an explosion of computational form factors. I remember going to get water as a kid in the 80s, I'm kidding, in the late 70s, and as I would walk to the kitchen, there would be like no lights at all. We didn't have our Timex Sinclair or our Z80s, didn't have any computers yet, but eventually there was one blinking light, and that was our VCR. And that little blue light was my beacon toward trying to navigate to the kitchen in the middle of the night. And then that was followed later by a blinking light in the kitchen, which was the microwave. Or maybe it was. And as I've grown through my life, we've had more and more of these blinking lights pepper through the mesh and fabric of our day-to-day living. And now we're at this point where every one of those blinking lights, and my kids walk to get water in the middle of the night, and there's like 30, 50, count. Go home, turn off all your lights, and count how many lights you see just in your house. And we have them in our cars. We have them in our offices. We have chosen to create computational form factors, and each one of those blinking lights represents some computation happening, a CPU, And we've started binding them with sensors that have gotten smaller and smaller and cheaper and cheaper. And this wasn't an overnight transition. It started slowly, but now when we look backward, we're now saturated. And there wasn't a specific time when this exactly happened. It was kind of like when you're checking your email. Remember back in the day, for those of you who are a little bit older, they would meter out how much you would have to pay for your web email. Oh, I got 5 megabytes. Oh, and my provider jumped up to 10 megabytes. That's crazy. I'm going to pay this much for 50 megabytes. And eventually, over time, people stop charging you, but you get a gigabyte, then you get 5 gigabytes, and now we have unlimited cloud. This didn't happen overnight, but when we look backward, this has been a fundamental shift in interaction and interaction design. The same thing has happened with computation. We can consider these us creating nerve cells of computation and sensors in every single part of our life, including our wearables, including the things that will be driving our VR devices. But this was this first revolution, building these nerve cells and peppering them through all walks of life. This led to the second revolution, which all of a sudden, just like we stopped paying for email storage, for cloud storage, and it became a commodity, all of these sensors and computational nerve cells, they used to be expensive. We'd set them up and we'd say, track this information because it's important to me enough to pay the cost of you tracking the information. And when that cost got to a certain level, we naturally stopped looking specifically for something and we just said, record everything. And now we have all these sensors and we're saying, record everything and push it up to the cloud and we'll figure it out later. This is a big shift also that was leading toward more mobile first, cloud first. We have nerve cells everywhere. We gave those nerve cells sensors, the ability to see, and now we've wired up these cells in a nervous system that's connected to the cloud internet. But it's the third one that keeps me up at night. The third one is the one that has finally brought all these together into something that is fundamentally changing computation and will fundamentally change design, and we're already feeling it. This emergence of cognitive algorithms. We know 2-3 years ago, the deep learning APIs came in, and all of this investment we've been making on machine learning started hitting this curve, and machines started getting really, really fast and really, really smart, more so than we were expecting previously. An interesting parallel can be found. We see when you look at the fossil record, there's an argument where you see a lot of simple systems, but as soon as vision is introduced to the fossil record, we have this explosion. We call it a Cambrian explosion of diversity and complexity. The same thing is happening in parallel to where we are with computation. We had nerve cells, we've bound them up into a nervous system, they're cloud enabled, and cognitive algorithms are coming up online to take all of that mountain of information and process it in a different way. When I say cognitive algorithms, I mean AI. When I say we have AI and AI is already here, I don't mean this type of AI. This is Hollywood AI. This is the gimmick, the magic trick AI. A machine that thinks like a human is about as useful as a robot that looks like a human. It's just a magic trick. It's something to divert the masses as we shift from a, and not we Microsoft, as humanity is making choices that seems to shift from a military-industrial complex to a marketing surveillance complex, driven by all of these algorithms and sensors and data, sure, but this is the kind of diversionary approach. It's not this Hollywood AI I'm talking about. I'm talking about this type of AI. This AI that we can't really put our fingers around, that we call cognitive algorithms, we call machine learning. I love this quote. It's artificial intelligence is just whatever a computer can't do yet, right? In the early 90s, it was like, we'll have AI when it can beat a human at chess. And that happened in 97. Well, we'll have AI, right, when we pass the Turing test. Debatably, that happened a year and a half ago in UK, when out of 100 professors, 30 of them thought that this artificial intelligence was an immigrant 13-year-old child. We keep kicking the definition of what AI is farther and farther down the field, because there isn't a hard definition of AI. I'm saying AI to provoke you, but we're calling them machine learning, cognitive learning. It's already here. Artists and designers are already working with AI. Last year, I don't know how many of you recognize this. This was the Deep Dream project, brought about through open source and some creative communities, where they're feedbacking in these cognitive algorithms and having them dream, inserting noise, creating that feedback loop, and they start pulling out images just like we do from the cloud, just like we see faces from Mars, and they start creating these banana slug dogs because we're allowing these AI computations to dream. 12 months ago, we have reports such as this, where computer-based personality judgments are more accurate than those made by humans. That means out of this data set, to basically break it down, it means from this group of Facebook users that came out, by simply looking at your likes, after 150 likes, these algorithms that they were testing out could predict your personality-based judgments more accurately than your mother and father. This was 12 months ago. At 280 likes, these algorithms were more accurate at predicting your personality-based judgments than your own spouse, the person you share your life with, the person you sleep with, the person that knows you better than anybody else in the world. These algorithms, by looking at 280 of your likes, could predict your personality judgments more accurately. This is 12 months ago. For this data set, the average number of likes were 237. So already 12 months ago, assuming no additional progress has happened, and that's a dumb assumption, these algorithms know you better than your parents and are quickly catching up to knowing you better than your own spouses. This one we mean AI is already here. When these four people 12 months ago and many, many others write an open letter saying we need to make sure as we're progressing with artificial intelligence that we're inserting morality into this research. We need to be having these conversations right now because our investments in cognition and vision algorithms and perception is growing so quickly, we got to be inserted. These aren't cranks. This is Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates, Wozniak, Iron Man, right? Or as close as Tony Stark as we actually have these days. When this guy, 6 months later, also sends another letter in terms of kill, no kill orders for the military and use of AI. This is 6 months ago. When the closest thing we have to Tony Stark from Tesla, privatizing space, when this guy says, hey, we got to slow down a little bit. This isn't a crank talking. This is the issue that's changing things. Let's put this one more way and then we'll loop back into how it applies to VAMR, to virtual augmented mixed and zero UI. Let's put it this way. 1995 was the 30th anniversary of Moore's Law, and this is Moore's story. This is correlation, not necessarily causation. I know a lot of your engineers might say, that's not how it works, but bear with me. 1995, 30th anniversary of Moore's Law, we hit 5,000 transistors on a CPU. Out of 30 years, we got to this point. This was around the population of LA and San Diego in 1995. They brought Moore out and he says, this is amazing. Out of 30 years, we've made 5 million transistors on a single CPU. This is the progress of mankind. And yet there's just market forces and there's laws of physics. I predict within the next 10 years, this will eventually ceiling off and stop. Now that's what Moore himself said in 1995. Moore's Law had a different approach. Went from 5 to 10 to 20 to 40 to 80 to 160. On the 40th anniversary of Moore's Law, they brought him out again. But the first one was the Pentium Pro, by the way, and this was the Pentium 4, I believe. We had reached 160 million transistors on CPU. Visually, that's the look. Now this was great, we were doing some good things in 2005, and Moore comes out and says, okay, this is banana nuts. Well, he might not have said banana nuts, I'm paraphrasing him. He says, okay, that's kind of crazy. It took us 30 years to get here, and in 10 years we got here, and yet there's just market forces. There's just reality when it comes to physics. There's a limit. Within the next 10 years, we'll have to start hitting this limit and stopping. 5 years later, the iPad 1 comes out, the Kinect is on the market. We start playing with these more personal computing technologies. We start playing with VR and AR, and we reach 1 billion transistors on a single chip. The 50th anniversary of Moore's Law, last year, the IBM X23 comes out with 7.1 billion transistors on a chip. That's a transistor for every man, woman, and child on Earth. This is where we are now in technology. And we still hear the same stories. There's just laws of physics. There's market realities. This will stop. I'm not here for us to speculate, to armchair quarterback, will this keep going? That wouldn't be good in a design conversation. If we are designers, we need to do what we do well as designers, which is mind the gap. If this is where we're at now, our question shouldn't be, how much farther is this going? Mind the gap. Our question should be, what in the world is going on with all this? Because since 2010, this guy, then our Windows phones, then our iPhones, 1-2 billion, after a billion transistors, who's really counting? You know, I mean, we're talking with numbers that are so ridiculously large, and yet we should be figuring out if this is where the majority of our experiences as people who interact with technology are still throttling back. Not much has changed that much since 2010 in terms of our experiences. Where's all this already being used? Much, much more important for us, for our intuition, than to thinking how far can it go? Because this is already there. Where is it being used? This has been our assumption of what software is for a very, very long time. And I talk a bit on this. Our software, we can view it as a axis of delight, from transactional software experiences that are production optimized to immersive experiences, including gaming, which is experience optimized. As we move toward the immersive side of software, things become more bespoke, more native, become more GPU heavy. As software moves toward the transactional and production optimized side, we fall more into the paradigms that have served us well for the past decade. A lot of you have made a lot of money off of these paradigms. App is equal to code plus markup. Make it easy so that the designers don't need to code. Let's really have a nice production line set up. That's a great approach for production transactional optimized software. And so we talk quite a bit about this. Design principles that are true for here are not true for here. Engineering functionalities that are good for here are not necessarily good for here. And we've had these debates back and forth in conversations because this has been the domain of software. And yet, up until now, this has assumed a 2D paradigm. That fundamental paradigm has never been challenged. Where has that computation that's grown crazy exponentially in the past 5 years gone? Because it hasn't been on our consumer experiences. It's blown out the walls on both sides. It's blown out the 2D lower boundary into one-dimensional experiences. We call zero UI, invisible UI. Things that do not require a screen. Machine learning, those AIs are being funneled by all of the big technology houses into your digital virtual assistants, cognitive learning, algorithm, Cortana, Google Now, Alexa, Siri. These abilities for you to not need to open up an app for your app to be of value to you. All of these things are being powered because of this walk we went through of what more personal computing and cloud first, mobile first actually enables. This invisible aspect, ambient computation. That's an entire new paradigm that's being exploded out that designers and engineers and creatives and hybrids will need to challenge our assumptions, because especially the more successful you've been here, the more your intuition is going to be wrong over there. And we'll get to that back in a minute. But it's also blown out the other wall from 1D zero UI, 2D's also expanded out into three-dimensional experiences, virtual, augmented, and mixed reality. And for mixed reality, not just perception devices, but projection-based mixed reality scenarios, where we're having rooms that are livable and projection mappings are coming in. This is the new domain of software experiences. So when we have UI design discussions, this is what it is. It's not that 2D's gone away, but both of the walls that have been so solid for us have now blown out. So when we go to people as Microsoft and we talk about this shift from personal computer to more personal computing, we really want us to understand, every person, engineers and designers, need to understand this is the shift, because if our intuition has been here, this is where we got to make sure our intuition is caught up. We're shifting from this area where personal computers were digital and causal and finite, true and false. We can consider that as a very, very smart, blind, black box. We would need to create a model of reality, insert that model of reality into this very, very smart blind box, and then query against that model that we created. This was what PCs did, and they did that very, very well. But if you query the wrong way, blue screen, right, or you query something that isn't in the model, there are faults with that. This shift that we're having now is with software being analog, free will, infinite maybes, probabilities coming in. The goal of AI and VR and all of these expanding technologies isn't just to simulate mankind. That's a Hollywood closed loop. It's to start having conversations with our technology, because we're giving them eyes and we're giving them brains and we're asking them what they think about the same problems that we're wrestling with. When my wife comes into my house, I don't need her to sign in before I hug her and give her a kiss. I'm really good at human recognition. I see her most of the time. I see her, and I don't usually go and hug random strangers. But when the Kinect sees her, the Kinect's very good at other things. And the Kinect can zero in on this little patch of skin under her eye and can drop down its perception to count micro fluctuations between color over time, and by so doing that, be able to pull out what her heartbeat is and other statistics about her. So I see my wife, and this Kinect-enabled AI sees my wife, and I see her differently, and it sees her differently. And it's these two different perspectives of intelligent entities that can start having conversations and start moving technology in an area that our paradigm is not up to date with yet. But this is the shift. So when we're talking about things like virtual, augmented, and mixed reality, and this is all really good, and this is great hype cycle, and that's fantastic, and I can't wait. I like playing with this stuff too, because I'm a content consumer as well as all of you. But when we think about this, expand our definition. Bruce Sterling challenges us. AR, okay, that's great, but who really does need their reality augmented? Is it just first world people with disposable income looking for gaming scenarios? Whose reality is challenged right now that should be augmented? Here's the Cities Unlocked project and Guide Dogs and Microsoft, where we're allowing 3D audio to augment blind people to move about their cities. It's not like AR and VR is just a visual play. Augmented reality, how do we augment reality for everybody? This is not just engineers down in a corner, and it's not just creatives blue sky, and it's a conversation of all these types of things, right? Thinking laterally, yes, this is something that creatives do very well. We think laterally and we find patterns. But we also need that conversation with engineering to make it possible. Right? Whose reality should be virtualized to bring them back in? This is also a garage project, right? Steve Gleason and AOLS. This should expand our definitions of what we think of as software, what more personal computing is about, and not just make it about gamers wanting to play in VR and AR and mixed reality. This was a great demo with, again, using vision algorithms and cognitive algorithms to translate Chinese sign language into audio so that we can have a mixed reality experience for this person who cannot speak with themselves. Their artificial voice can be driven by their hands in the same way. So there are a couple challenges, wrapping up this talk, there are a couple challenges that we have that I've been focusing on myself, and I'd love help with this. If for nothing else, helping get the message out. But these are the problems that I'm really focusing on right now and trying to see what we can do to help here through the garage and in our own groups. The first challenge we have that we've been talking about is this intuition of interaction. We're going to be getting devices online, our own devices and additional devices working in our ecosystem. And our intuition might still be locked in an old paradigm. I wasn't at Microsoft when this came out. I was an MVP and my agency was a good partner with Microsoft. I got to play heavily with the Surface Table 2008, 2009 when it came out. How many of these experiences, and I love this table by the way, how many of these experiences did you see that was basically replacing a finger with a mouse? This device, which was so ahead of its time, supported 52 points of touch simultaneously. That's five people sitting around this table doing 10 key entry. It was capable of it. But it got seeded out in the design agencies and the technical agencies and the development shops. The intuition wasn't there yet. There was so much horsepower in this device, and nobody took it out of first gear. I'd hate to see that happen again with HoloLens. It has nothing to do with the engineering that's gone in, because we have very, very good engineers making incredible products. But if our messaging isn't there and we don't bridge the gap all the way across, we don't want to have this repeat. This broke my heart. Intuition of interaction. It's not just about the device. It's about how you create these experiences around it. There's this great article already 3-4 years old. You might want to look it up. Just search for A Brief Rant on the Future of Interaction Design by Brett Victor. It's a great, great, great blog post. And he challenges us broadly, us computer people, not just Microsoft. If our intuition is such, especially as a designer, that we still feel the future of software is pushing pictures under glass, because everything that we're seeing today that was still made under the 1 billion, 2 billion processor limit, if it's just pushing pictures under glass, and yeah, you make the pictures prettier and you can charge more, or you make the pictures dumber and it's more scale, right? But if this is our intuition, that this is all the future of software, pushing pretty pictures under glass, our intuition is wrong. It's 2016 now. That intuition that has paid us very well is now wrong. Our world has gotten much, much broader. Both dimensions have exploded out. We need to start bringing in a new way of thinking. The second challenge is one of dimensionality. Even when we're seeing crazy awesome, this was on build, this one was for the HoloLens, the robot camera. I loved this demo. I don't know who worked on it. I'm not on the analog team. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. But even here, when we bring up the interfaces, we keep dropping down to floating postcards in space. This idea of, well, I'm doing something cool, but when I need to interact with it, I'm going to drop back down into 2D postcards in space. That may or may not have been the right solution. I don't know. I didn't work on this problem. We might work through it and decide, yes, it is the right solution. But was it even challenged? Because the problem is, with dimensionality, we haven't been taught to think of dimensionality. That's why everything with Oculus and the HTC Vive and all of these devices, everybody's going to gamers, which we're going to get to, because gamers are used to thinking in terms of dimensionality, but we have been conditioned not to think in terms of dimensionality. We don't know how to teach it. We don't have the tools to work for it, which we'll get to next. We don't know how to hire for it. So we're just going to blindly hire game developers? Well, that's what everybody's doing right now. But what's going to be the sustainable solution moving forward? Dimensionality. It's going to be a very strong challenge. The one we have now that's come a long way from when I started giving this presentation is frameworks and support. This is also a developer challenge and a designer challenge. And it also where there's opportunity. As a quick reminder, working with dimensionality for several years now, back in the day, on the Microsoft stack in blue, and on the rest of the world down in green, if you recall, maybe 10 years ago, most of you came here, this is what we had. We had some good tools, WPF 3D, Silverlight, XNA from the Microsoft camp, Flash. And we killed all those with this push toward simple UI, Metro, and all these types of things. Apple came in, didn't support Flash. That pretty much was its death knell. So all of these things that a lot of us 10 years ago were playing with dimensionality, they all got killed out from under us. We didn't know what to do anymore. The Windows 8 story was a little harsh, right? We said, well, do it in C# and XAML if you want to be flat. If you want to do anything else, do it in C++ and DirectX. I consider myself a pretty smart person. I tried learning C++ and DirectX from the ground floor, and I had brain leaking out of my ears 6 months later. It was one of the hardest things I had to do. It is not easy. Kudos to all of you who work with C++ and DirectX. And I've still been trying, maimed, right? I have the Stockholm syndrome with it. I still love it. I'm still trying to learn it. But it's really, really hard. Because the other people like me who are creative hybrids, they started gravitating toward OpenGL and WebGL technologies, which runs on our desktop, but does not run on our Windows 10 store, or did not run on our Windows 10 store in Windows 8. This was a very, very hard time for many of us. This space of people that now they're words for it. Now you have design technologists. Now you have technical producers. Now you have design fiction. Now it's become an industry thing. But they've started aggregating around frameworks, processing, Arduino, which is basically processing for Internet of Things. These have been reactions as people are trying to fill this middle of experimental engineering. Open frameworks and Cinder. Now with Windows 10, we're starting to be able to change this. C++ and DirectX are making investments to be easier with things like Win2D, but we still have that challenge of dimensionality. But now we're able to have solutions that leverage Angle, which allows us to convert DirectX calls to OpenGL. That is starting to enable some of these frameworks, such as Cinder, is starting to be enabled on Windows 10 for Windows Store applications. That's crazy, crazy good news. But one of the biggest things that has come here, because, let me step back. This is what I've spent most of my time focusing on, and if you have any questions about any of these, please reach out to me. But my next year has really been focused on this. Unity has kind of become the new Flash. It's not just at Microsoft, everywhere. Because Unity kind of happened to be at the right place in the right time, was already addressing these challenges of dimensionality. So Oculus, Vive, all of these places are now kind of going to Unity. I don't know if this is our long-term win, but right now it's our good enough win. My challenge is there's almost zero content for creative coding with Unity. You look for Unity content, it's all about, hey, you want to be an indie gamer? Here's a guy jumping on Mushroom. But nobody's talking about how you would teach creative coding in a Unity space. I'll be looking to address that myself broadly for cross-platform Unity development, as well as low-level, extreme graphics abilities of Unity when you're targeting the Windows Store specific APIs. And today we also have additional advancement with JavaScript. So this talk's been the kickoff talk to introduce what the next series of talks we want to do here in the garage are. Again, I'm not with the garage, but Mike Pell and Raleigh are here with the garage. They've been working very hard to try and have these types of conversations to get us all together and start working out these problems. So right off the bat, we want to be looking at some Internet of IoT sessions. The next sessions will be more hands down. My classes will try and be 0 to 100 deep dives. I'm not planning on doing an introduction to creative coding for Unity, but if there's enough of that response from the community, because there isn't a lot of content out there, if you want to play with this more, let me know and I'll think about it. I wasn't planning on doing an introductory course, but I'd be more than happy to set this up through the garage. But for sure, we want to be doing deep dives into using Unity and Kinect and Windows Store for VR situations, or Unity and Kinect and desktop for Oculus. Unity and Windows Store for things like Windows Cardboard. Who needs one of these? I have one. All right, first person to raise your hand, there you go.
Yay, Janelle.
That was like a cheap speaker trick, like give something away, so all right, there you go. I need that back, actually, no, I'm just kidding, that's yours. Kinect and OpenCV, right? And as we give these talks, the whole reason we want to record this talk, and thank you for being here and for listening. It might not have been exactly what you were expecting, but because I don't want you to think of these next talks that we'll be doing throughout the year building up toward the next one-week hackathon. Because Satya did an amazing thing with the hackathon the first year. He said it's open to everybody, not just production engineers. All of a sudden, we started having hackathons of ideas and design fiction popping up. This is great. That's the Microsoft I want to work for. I'm spending all of my energy to try and help us get to that Microsoft, because that's the Microsoft I want to work for, where designers and creatives and hybrids and engineers are more tightly integrated. It's not just production-optimized engineering. It also encourages experimentalist engineering, rapid innovation, and embraces risk and embraces our passions. So these talks, don't just view them independently. Please keep in mind this broader expanse of what's happening in software, not just at Microsoft, but broadly. So that's hopefully a sneak peek at what's coming out this year leading up to Satya's hackathon, working with Mike and Raleigh. But it's not just all me. So if there's any of these topics you're passionate about, you want to give a talk on as well, please talk to Mike and Raleigh as well. It's a grassroots movement we're trying to do. Thank you so much, everybody, for showing up. And anything I can do, right, or you want to keep talking or have lunch or whatever, there I am. Questions, Rick Barraza, and best way to get a hold of me. Thank you very much.